So in this talk, I would like to focus a little bit on the issue of security and insecurity, our fear and fearlessness. And I use the famous last words of the Buddha as a title for this day: be an island to yourself. And it's an interesting contemplation. These were the last recorded words of the Buddha. According to Stephen Batchelor, he was, at the end of his life, alone with one or two disciples only. The whole Sangha was scattered all over North India. and there was a sense, at least in Stephen Batchelor's reading of this, that the Buddha found himself kind of abandoned by the Sangha and by the world around. And I've no idea, of course, if that's the case, but that's a reading. Nevertheless, he chose, as the sentence, actually the sentence before the last, to say, be an island to yourself. And that's really worth thinking about. Why? What's the importance? And I think the importance to me is that we actually never really free ourselves from existential insecurity in the deepest level. It keeps on finding us again and again. And even on the very subtle levels, we sometimes find that that's the issue of the fundamental existential insecurity of all living beings, which translates into the three poisons, greed, hate and delusion, in action or in feeling or in relationship. But the basis of it, in a way, is our need to survive, our dependence on survival, our interest in survival, and leading there to insecurity. And the Buddha said, be an island and practice diligence. Practice seriously. And so I think that we ought to contemplate that a little bit. An island, in a sense, doesn't mean an island cut off, because actually all islands are anyway connected under the sea. It means being steady. I must have used this word already today at least 500 times, so it's a bit of a brainwash. But there is something very, very important about that sense of autonomy. Because in there is belonging, is being at home, is being connected, is being free, and not being insecure about what we don't know, what might happen, what we can't predict, what might change, what we might lose. So in the present moment, relationship with experience, the sense of autonomy is really helpful and important to us. And it actually does allow us, in a way, to invite experiences that otherwise we would be afraid of. So it's, in a way, helps us with the unknown, the things that are beyond, which we all want. We all have a longing for the beyond, but sometimes it's the fear that stops us there. And the fear can actually increase sometimes with in our spiritual journey. Because what happens in awareness, practices with awareness, is that we begin to, in a way, disintegrate the external armor, the shield, the external shield, which is keep away, don't disturb me, keep away, don't interfere with me, the shield. I don't want to be attacked, I don't want to be interfered with, I don't want to be disturbed. The reactivity that comes from the external shield, the protection outside. So that tends to disintegrate as we practice. The mindfulness itself means that we don't have this as much automatic defenses. And sometimes the mindfulness practice, as you know yourself, I remember the first retreats I did with Goenka many, many years ago, I would come out of there oh, what's happening? Where am I? How do I negotiate the craziness of India? And all I wanted to do was go back in the shell again and sort of hide. I couldn't face this sort of craziness of India. So we can get more sensitive sometimes and more open. And the truth is, we are not busy with anesthesia. Mindfulness and the awareness practice is the opposite of anesthesia. It is about being open and sensitive and awake and allowing life to touch us. And sometimes it can make us a bit afraid. And sometimes it can make us feel vulnerable. And so it is, can actually, it's something we really need to pay attention to. I read somewhere that scientists have decided that the brain background state is constant mild anxiety. That's the background. And we do often feel that more or less anything can upset us at any time or often, and we don't quite know why we get upset so quickly or so easily, and we get defensive, especially inside the family. People close to us, in a sense under our guard, can just create defensive and reactivity. And even if we're the best meditators and we are years in the practice, things can go under our guard because of primal fear, not because we are some way not successful. And we shouldn't blame ourselves about this. It happens because of existential security that is every ant, insect, bird, fish, animal, human being is sharing, that primal insecurity that will automatically arise even when we feel we're the best, calmest meditators in the world. So we have to pay attention to it. And there are a number of antidotes and a number of ways that we can directly address this primal insecurity. I have a personal story where this came up really strong. From childhood, I've had fear of heights, and couldn't bear to sort of look over the edge of a wall down there. It would just make me nauseous and want to fall over and dizzy and so on. This has been there since childhood. So I tried to beat it. And one of the ways I did this is I spent 1 month building a roof of my house. So I was up on the roof every day with a friend, hammering the tiles and the wood beams and so on. And every time I had that feeling of, in the stomach, nausea, here it is again, hold the hammer, touch of real things, completely in the present moment, hammering nails, and it really went away. And over 1 month, I felt that I'd beaten the problem. Until about 3 or 4 years ago, I was in Switzerland, walking with my sister in the Alps. And walking, it was the end of the day, so we were on our way home, going down the afternoon after a long hike the whole day. And walking, and all of a sudden, this side of the path turned into a cliff. But there was the other side. But this side turned into a sheer cliff going down kilometers down. There were tiny little houses down there and tiny little trees, and the path was just sort of... So it was okay because there was another side, except another kilometer on, the other side also dropped away. And I was walking on a very narrow ridge, and the whole thing came back. I fell on my face. I couldn't walk one more step. I felt dizzy, nausea. I felt that the fear was going to make me jump over. It was this cycle of fear in the mind that I was dizzy, I didn't know what to do. And I fell down and sort of hug the ground, and I can't move. So I was there for a few minutes, and the first thing is that the realization was things like this seem to never disappear. They're some way lurking in the background, ready to come out at certain situations, but I was assuming it had gone, but it hadn't gone. And I got up, I breathed, slowly came back, I breathed, sat up, stood up, looked at this, then I said, okay, what's all this Dharma going to, how is it going to help me now? I realized that the thing that I have to do is to have no processing or no interpretation of anything that the eyes or the ears see. And so I could walk again as long as nothing had any implication or messages called, I'm up here and it's few kilometers down there and a few kilometers down there. So I saw the houses down there as little red marks and the trees down there as little green blobs. And kind of, as long as I stayed in this direct sensation without any processing, it was fine. And I could concentrate 10 minutes with that, and then suddenly the whole thing came up and I would fall down again. I managed to get the few 2 or 3 kilometers walk on the ridge and got home. I couldn't go back anyway, so I had no choice. So it taught me a couple of things. One is that this is very deep. These primal fears are very deep, and we shouldn't underestimate them, and we should hold them carefully. And the second thing is, it taught me, as the classic teaching, that mindfulness is an antidote for fear, that mindfulness itself, by being in a world of contact and not processing or not building story and building constructions in the mind, it's a primary antidote for fear. And it's exactly what we've been doing this morning. Just sitting, breathing, sitting steady, walking on the earth is enough to deal with a lot of our insecurity, our fundamental insecurity, and make us feel we are here, belonging in the world, part of the world, with no reason to be afraid. Apart from that, there are some specific directions that we can practice with that will help fundamental insecurity, will help us to be an island. And one of them, of course, is trust. And I'm not going to go into trust too much at this point, but it's important as a reminder. It's one of the spiritual powers that we practice and aid us on the journey. Trust is a big power. A big power. It's a way of acting in relationship to our experience. It's a way of turning towards our experience and trusting it. It's a way of it is an active thing. Trust is an active thing. It's something that we forget and we remember. We forget and we remember. We trust the process. We can trust the unknown. If we're faced with experiences we don't understand, we can trust those experiences. We can trust, we can try and live with trust. I had a debate some years ago when, as I say, I built my house, whether to put locks on the doors. And we didn't. And I've lived there 30 years. And we don't have locks on our doors. Okay, it's a different context. I do have a big Alsatian dog. Maybe he's instead of the locks. But I regard him as a friend and not as a defender. But in any event, we've been 30 years there in the Middle East without any locks on the doors. And it's a kind of choice. I don't say you should do that, by the way. There's no reason to do any special action like that. But it's just a sort of reminder that the world is not against us. We may react like that because of the samsaric habit of the survival mind. But actually, the world is not against us. Nor is the world for us. The world is with us. I want to read a quote by Rilke. He says, "We have no reason to mistrust our world, for it is not against us. It has its terrors, but they are our terrors. It has its abysses, and those belong to us. Perhaps all the dragons of our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us, both beautiful and brave. Perhaps everything terrible is in its deepest being something helpless that wants our love." And so even in difficult situations, even where we feel life is threatening, is challenging, is pressing our buttons, is making us afraid or insecure, perhaps it's issues of health, perhaps it's issues of the environment, perhaps it's issues of medicine, perhaps it's the police, perhaps it's wars, but the world is fundamentally not against us, and we can choose to trust and choose it actively and keep trusting. And the trust then belongs to us. It is inside us. It's a shift in the inner life. And it carries us all the way through. I think it's important to understand, however, that the insecurity of living beings is something so fundamental that there isn't really, in the end, a way to repaint the picture or cover it over with pink colour. That the trust is wise, it's wise to develop trust, but fundamentally, the only real answer to insecurity is awakening and enlightenment and the path to it. The liberation from being a self is really, in the end, the only place where fundamental insecurity is really disintegrated. There's a quote from the Buddha on this, and he was asked in the middle length sayings, always one of his monks asked him, "Always frightened is my mind. The mind is always agitated about problems that haven't yet arisen and about problems that have arisen. If there exists any release from fear, please, I ask you, tell me, declare it to me." And the Buddha said, "Not apart from enlightenment and austerity, not apart from restraining the senses, the faculties of the senses, not apart from renunciation, do I see any safety for living beings." And it's a fundamental statement that says the awakening process, the process of liberation itself, is the in a way, the bottom line here, that austerity means letting go of the unnecessary things. Simplicity is part of that. It helps. The renunciation helps, the sense of not needing, not having to have, to let go of things, let go of unnecessary things, let go of our needs, including, for example, the need that we have to be alive. Renouncing the fact that I need to be alive, and I'm driving myself for this, and I must be alive tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day. Even that, the sense of letting all of that go, there, only there is in the end an answer to fear or insecurity. There's nothing apart from. So all the antidotes can really help us, but they're not in the end going to deal with fundamental fear, because it is so basic. And the Buddha was asked, so how does a monk be an island to himself? How is this done? Monks, be islands to yourselves, be a refuge to yourselves with no other refuge. Let the Dhamma be your island, let the Dhamma be your refuge with no other refuge. And how do we, does a monk, how do we stay as an island to ourselves? Here we stay contemplating the body as the body, keen, aware, mindful, put aside the hankering and the fretting for the world and the craving for the world. You stay contemplating feelings as feelings, mind as mind, mind objects as mind objects, keen, aware, mindful, having put aside the fretting and the hankering for the world. That is how we practice being an island to ourselves. So the message, I think, is quite clear, that mindful awareness, the practice that we're doing, keen, aware, mindful, being in the four foundations of the of mindfulness, body, feelings, mind, and mind objects, expressed in this quote, there is the place where if we are in that practice, the fear reduces and we become islands. Islands to ourselves, we find the refuge in mindfulness, in awareness, in practice, in the spiritual journey of the Dhamma. So I think that between the two, with an awareness of trust, with reminding ourselves about trust, with messages that are quite legitimate to put into our practice again and again, relaxing, for example, I'm walking, how's my tummy? Is my tummy contracted? Contraction of the tummy is a very sensitive signal of some fundamental insecurity. I mean, all of you now, maybe you can feel it. If you can let go your tummy, just let go. And how many of you, maybe all of us, have some small contraction in the tummy because of our fundamental fear? Little bit, maybe in some corner. Is an example, relaxing the stomach, relaxing the body, feeling softness, feeling ease, feeling belonging and being at home. These are messages that we can include wisely in our practice. And that gradually we learn to live without resistance. And there's a beautiful image of this, metaphor of this, that comes from actually from the Sufi tradition, but it's just pure Dharma. And I would like you to kind of remember these three images, because they're going to be the subject of some Dharma dialogue soon. So in the Sufi practice, or in the Sufi metaphors, It said that there's three ways or three images of working with insecurity or fear or challenge. One is the basket. The basket. Basket made of straw. What happens when the wind takes a basket? The wind blows the basket, and the basket can roll and roll and roll and roll, and it always ends up whole. It is not destroyed by the wind. The basket can just roll, and the wind doesn't destroy it. And how that certainly rings a bell for us. How something can challenge us, but because we're light and we can roll, it does affect us. It does affect us, a challenge, a disease, a problem, an issue. Don't know what, the bank phones up and says, you have less money than you think you did. We roll, it knocks us over, but we come out all right. We come back okay. We are still whole. Yes, we're affected by it, but we're whole. We are not destroyed by these winds of change. A second model or a second image is the image of the rock. An image of the rock is something more resistant but solid. Maybe it's more close to what we were thinking of as island. And the water can stream past the rock, and the rock stays there, connected to the earth, solid, apparently, although so rocks in the end get worn down. But it has a kind of metaphoric quality to it of things can pass by, but I'm staying in the middle of it. And we can feel that as we sit also. I'm sitting here 45 minutes like a rock, learning to be steady and like a rock or a mountain. And things can pass by, thoughts, memories, difficulties, pains in the body, but I'm a rock. That's another very nice image. And the third, which is perhaps more of the three, more dharmic, is the glass, where some experience can come and it just passes through because we're empty. It passes through. We're transparent. Experiences arise and they pass through us. Experiences arise and they pass through us. So this sense of transparency is another image. In the dharmic world, especially the world of traditional Dharma, traditional Buddhist practice, there is quite a lot of encouragement to meet, even artificially, to arouse difficulty, to arouse our vulnerability in order to stand firm with it, in order to allow it and not to be knocked over by it. There's a lot of practices, even Satipatthana Sutta, in many other texts, and certainly the monks do a lot of practices around, for example, death and dying, visualizing the body in decomposing, visualizing the body as dying, visualizing and remembering the body as vulnerable, the self as vulnerable. And here is some kind of, I would say, psychological vaccination or inoculation, where we, by again and again holding the ultimate vulnerability in our hands, in our consciousness, and being all right with it, and being free. And in those places we can still stay free, be islands, be free, be the rock or the basket or the glass, and still, and and still touch death, passing, loss, then there is, it's a kind of fast track way to the freedom beyond self. These practices, including the practices on death and dying, and a kind of repeating or meeting the ultimate challenge of death, is a very strong practice inside the Theravada tradition, and not only the Theravada tradition. And it kind of invites us to be free of the ultimate challenge, and therefore be less selfing, less protective, less busy with self and what I need and how I must survive and the fear that goes with it. So I want to finish the talk with just this sense of small contemplation of how are we with that question, island. How are we with the sense of autonomy? Be an island to ourselves, are we islands to ourselves? Leave it as a koan, as a question, something that we focus on during the day together and in our lives too. What does it do to us when we hear this, our island? Contemplating it, how am I? How do I feel with being an island? So we'll take a couple of minutes just to feel that and in quietness.